And I hope the weather wasn't too difficult for you. And Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has rachamim on us, so it hasn't been so bad. But unfortunately, as all of you know, there have been tragedies in Europe and France. And we should be mispalel that the families that suffered bereavements should be comforted with all the Aveli Tzion v'Yerushalayim. And once again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu does allow us to remember in many, many ways in Eretz Yisrael and Chutz Laretz that we are still in Galus, and we need the Mashiach, we need the Geula Shleima that should be B'mheira V'yameinu. And indeed, it is perhaps not by accident, certainly not by accident, that we are beginning now the Parshios of Yetzias Mitzrayim. And everybody remembers from the Haggadah a passage that is really from the Mishnah, that Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ke'ilu Hu Yatzo Mimitzrayim. Each person must regard themselves as if they personally were taken out of Mitzrayim, that it is not simply commemoration, but it is actual experience. And the emes is that the Baal HaTanya says, what does that even mean? What does it mean, each person must regard himself as if they were in Mitzrayim? I was never in Mitzrayim, I was not a slave. And be sure that you don't confuse this with another statement. There is another statement in the Haggadah, that if HaKadosh Baruch Hu would not have taken our forefathers out of Mitzrayim, we would still be there. But that's not the same thing as saying, Hashem took us out. That's saying, I am grateful for what was done to my ancestors, because had it not been done to my ancestors, we would have been on the 50th level of Tumah, we would have disappeared. But that's not the same thing as saying, I must regard myself as if I was taken out of Mitzrayim. Because that implies I myself was in Mitzrayim. So the Baal HaTanya explains, again, homiletically, al derech ha-chasidus, that Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is the ancient nation of Egypt, not the modern Egyptians, but the ancient nation of Egypt. And certainly the Jewish people were enslaved, and there were 10 plagues, etc. And that is a historical reality. Anyone that simply says it's a metaphor is a kofir in the Torah. The Torah clearly says it happens. But Mitzrayim also means limitations, constrictions, blockages. When David HaMelech says in Tehillim, Min ha-meitzar karasi ka, that means out of the narrow, confining places, Meitzar, Mitzrayim, I call out to God. And therefore, Mitzrayim is not simply an external condition of slavery or persecution, but Mitzrayim exists within every neshama that finds itself trapped and blocked in its ability to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Everybody has their own Mitzrayim. A person might have anger, selfishness, materialism, depression, hopelessness. All of this is our own inner Mitzrayim, because it blocks us, it imprisons us, it enslaves us, it rules over us. You know, if you've ever had the negative experience of feeling of holding a grudge, I assume that no one ever has a grudge here, because the Torah says it's usher. So I'm just giving a hypothetical example. You get a real sense sometimes of how something is really possessing you, that you know you have to let go of it. You know you have to move on. But it is as real as a physical chain that is chaining you to a place. That is Mitzrayim. So, Yetzias Mitzrayim means that around Pesach time, and I'll connect it to these parshios, HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts into the world a power of liberation. And that same power of redemption and liberation that enabled our forefathers to be taken out of the slavery of Mitzrayim is a koach that we can connect to that enables us to be liberated from our Mitzrayim. So the inner meaning of Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo Ke'ilu Yatzo Mimitzrayim is a recognition that the spiritual kaychais that Hashem puts into the Bria that create historical events are not just historical events. They are spiritual realities that come in every single time.
Now, ideally, of course, that refers to Pesach. But the Svarim tell us that the parshios in which we read in the Torah, the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim, we experience Yetzias Mitzrayim in the language of the Mekubalim in Zeir Anpin. Zeir Anpin is just Aramaic for microcosm. Meaning to say, this is a mini Pesach. This is Pesach without having to clean your house. So it's even a little easier. But Lamaisa, we connect to the Koach of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But that means we have to identify the Mitzrayim within us and then turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give us the ability to be redeemed from whatever that Mitzrayim is. And as the saying goes, it was easier to take the Jew out of Mitzrayim than it is to take Mitzrayim out of the Jew. That's again a very, very difficult Aveda. But that is the great gift of these Parshios, and of course that'll be the great gift of Pesach. The Baal HaTanya again, Chayav Adam Liros HaSatzmo, Ki Ilu Hu Yatzah Mi Mitzrayim. I have my own Yitzias Mitzrayim. My own Mitzrayim, and my own Yitzias Mitzrayim. Now we know that the centrality of remembering Yitzias Mitzrayim is so important that there are actually two separate mitzvahs. There is a daily mitzvah, and there's an annual mitzvah. Every single day of the year, we have a mitzvah in the Torah, this is men and women, to remember verbally, not just in the mind, but to articulate verbally that Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. This is in the third parsha of Shema, because again, Kriya Shema is only two parshas, Shema and Vayom Shemoa. Parshas Vayomer, Tzitzis, the primary reason why we mention it, or at least one of the primary reasons, is because of the pasuk, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, Asher Otesi Eschem Me'eretz Mitzrayim. And if you look at your art scroll sitter or whatever sitter you use, there will sometimes be a comment in the art scroll sitter, on the art scroll sitter, maybe not every sitter, that says, when you say the pasuk, Ani Hashem Elokeichem, you shall have specific kavana to fulfill, not the mitzvah of Shema, but another mitzvah, the mitzvah that is called Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim, remembering the Exodus. And this is based on the pasuk, Leman Tiskor Es Yom Seischa Me'eretz Mitzrayim. You have to remember the day that you left Mitzrayim, Kol Yemei Chayecha, all the days of your life. And if you recall from the Haggadah, which is really a Mishnah, there is an argument, if the extra word kol is superfluous, is it coming to tell me even at night, and not just in the day? Or is it coming to tell me even when Mashiach comes, and the miracles will be so much greater, we still have to remember it? We do Paskin, that we have to do it in day and at night. In fact, let me just explain. That is actually why women are obligated. Had it only been a mitzvah in the daytime, it would have fallen under the category of a mitzvah sasei shezman gerama, because it applies day and night. That is exactly why women are chayavis as well. So although women are not obligated in the Shema, technically, because Shema is only part of the day, so it is a time-bound commandment, but women are obligated to remember the Exodus.
Once a day?
They should do it twice a day. They should do it twice a day. Yeah, so just say a pasuk. Ani Hashem Elokeichem. Yeah, just one pasuk. You don't have to say the whole parsha of anything. Now, here is the thing. This is a daily mitzvah. And this mitzvah is called Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. We then, of course, have an annual mitzvah, which is the mitzvah of the Seder, and that is called the mitzvah of Sipur Yitzias Mitzrayim, and that is based on a different pasuk. V'higadata levincha, you shall tell your child, hence the word Haggadah for the book that we use. On that day, which really means the night, the Haggadah tells me that. Because of all that Hashem did for me when we were taken out of Mitzrayim, that is why we have the Haggadah. So, daily mitzvah is called Zechira. Annual mitzvah, again, in Chutz Laaretz they do it twice, but here we do it once, because it is only a once a year mitzvah, is called Haggadah. Now, why are women obligated in that? Because the Chara, that is the Mangrama, that is only the night of the 15th of Nisan. The Gemara's answer is that we compare all of the positive commandments of Pesach to the negative prohibitions of Chametz, so whoever has the negatives has the positives. So this is one of the many, many exceptions to the exemption of Zman Gerana. Okay, but again, the nomenclature is different. During the year, it is Zechira, remembrance, and Pesach night, it is called Sipor, narration. So there's a famous thought that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik used to explain at the beginning of every Seder. So his family heard it a number of times. And that is the following. Even if the Torah wouldn't have given me a mitzvah of Sipor, I would have had to mention the Exodus anyway because of Zechira. So what is the annual mitzvah adding that I didn't have to do anyway? Now you might say, well, what do you mean what's adding? You got to read the Haggadah. That's a lot more. But that's not a good answer. Because in fact, the Torah does not say you have to read the Haggadah. The Torah says you got to talk about the Exodus, in your own words even. So insofar as the Haggadah itself is a product of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, in which they put together different passages, but it is not a biblically mandated text. The Torah does not say you must say the Haggadah. And in fact, as far as we think, you might be Yotze, the mitzvah of Sipur, with one pasuk. And if that's the case, what is Sipur adding? I would have had to do it anyway because of Zechira. So Rav Chaim explains that there are four structural elements in the mitzvah of Sipur that go beyond the mitzvah of Zechira. And although the Haggadah is technically a rabbinic text, the structure of the Haggadah is based on an amplification and an elaboration of these four elements. So Rav Chaim says we're going to differentiate between Zechira, B'chol Yemos Hashana, and what the Torah says Sipur. So Sipur can be in your own words, to be sure. D'oraisa, you don't need a Haggadah, but you've got to incorporate the following four elements. Element number one, the whole year, I just say, Hashem took me out of Mitzrayim, took us out of Mitzrayim. Pesach night, it has to go through a question and answer process. You can't just do Jeopardy, give the answer, whatever it is. Actually, Jeopardy, give the question. Okay. You have to do a question and answer. Hence, that is the famous Manishtana. But if you look in the Gemara, you actually see that Manishtana is really cheating. Ideally, people should have their own questions. But Nebuch, people don't have their own questions, so we give them the questions to ask. But even if you're by yourself and there's nobody asking you the questions, you have to ask questions. Shela Utshuva. I remember years ago when I was a small child, so we were once at a family, say, not wasn't, I won't say, we were a guest in somebody's house. And I still remember this because it was very funny to me even then, that the kids were asking a lot of questions during the Seder. So the father got a little impatient, and he said, "Stop asking questions, we've got to do the Seder." So it's kind of missing the point a little bit, but okay. Alright, now I'm going to come back to this later, because I really want to focus on a second element. Okay, the second element is, the whole year, you just talk about the good part of the story. Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim. Pesach night, there is what the Mishnah calls Maschil Bignus Umisayem Bishvach. Maschil Bignus means you must begin with the negative, you must begin with the shame, with the degradation, and then you culminate in the redemption. And there's even a machlokas in the Gemara, what degradation are we talking about? One opinion says the degradation of slavery, Avadim Hayinu, and one says the degradation that we were idolaters, Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoseinu, which means the Haggadah has two different storylines. There is the journey of slavery to freedom, and there is the journey from pantheism or paganism to Emunah in Hashem. And there's actually a machlokas in the Gemara, which one do you do? And we do both. Very, very interesting. If you read the Gemara literally, the Gemara seems to suggest there were actually two versions of the Haggadah. There was version A that emphasized slavery, and version B that emphasized paganism. And our Haggadahs are a composite mixture of those two versions. That's very, very fascinating. I saw that Rav David Cohen, a very, very chashuva Rav and Talmud Chacham in Flatbush, actually tries to go through the Haggadah paragraph by paragraph to identify which belong to version A. It's like an archaeological reconstruction. Which belong to version A and which belong to version B and how they got mixed. Actually, the Malbim learns very differently. The Malbim learns everybody had the same Haggadah. It's just a question of what the Mishnah means when it says degradation. In other words, the Malbim learns it's just a matter of nomenclature. But the simple meaning of the Gemara is there were two different versions of the Haggadah. Now, the bulk of my share is going to talk about this one, but I just want to mention the two others just to have our list. So, number one is Shelu Tshuva, question and answer. Number two is begin with the bad and culminate in the good. Number three is the statement of Rabban Gamliel that people remember. Rabban Gamliel says, anyone that does not explain three commandments does not fulfill his mitzvah, and the three commandments are why we eat the Korban Pesach, why we eat the matzah, why we eat the maror. If one does not explain this, one does not fulfill their mitzvah. Now, what mitzvah don't you fulfill? So the Rishonim explain. It doesn't mean you don't fulfill Korban Pesach unless you talk about it. All you have to do is eat it. It doesn't mean you don't fulfill matzah unless you talk about it. I fulfill matzah by eating. It doesn't mean I don't fulfill maror unless I talk about it. I do. What mitzvah don't I fulfill? I don't fulfill the mitzvah of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. That the narrative of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim has to integrate an explanation of the tangibles, like a multimedia thing. You have to integrate the tangible mitzvos that you're doing into the narration. That is, of course, unique only to Sipur. The rest of the year, I don't have to mention Pesach Maror. By the way, the Chayyada mentions an important point. This, maybe we'll talk about closer to Pesach, but this part of the Haggadah is towards the end of the Maggid, and the meal is approaching. So the people who go into the kitchen, I don't want to be sexist, so whether it's the man or the woman, whether it's the husband or the wife, whoever goes into the kitchen, it is precisely this paragraph that they might miss. And this is very important. The Haggadah is not like Megillas Esther, meaning if you miss a line here and there, you're okay. It's not like you've lost the mitzvah. It's not like Megillah, where if you didn't hear a pasuk, you have to read the pasuk. But the one part of the Haggadah that you cannot miss is the Rabban Gamliel paragraphs. So therefore, the Chai Adam says that a person that's going to be leaving the room when those paragraphs are recited should either read ahead, read it before they go, or be sure to read it before Netilas Yadayim, before the second cup, just to get it in. And then, of course, like anything else in the Haggadah, in any language, you know, you read it. In fact, the most important thing is it be in a language that you understand. But this is a part of the Haggadah that is ma'akev, right? So far we have three chilukim. Chiluk number one, Shelu Tshuva. Chiluk number two, Maschil Bignus Umisayim Bishvach. Chiluk number three, the imperative of explaining Pesach Matu Mora. Now, the fourth element actually was not said by Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim said these three elements. The fourth element was said by his son, the Brisker Rav, Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim was also the Brisker Rav, but the title Brisker Rav we normally give typically to Rav Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik because he was the last Rav of Brisk before the Holocaust. He was the last Rav of the community of Brisk, and he was, Baruch Hashem, smuggled out of the Warsaw Ghetto, and he managed to come to Eretz Yisrael, although he had lost his wife and he had lost some children. And he lived in Eretz Yisrael for around 15 years, from 1945 to 1960. Nifter on Yom Kippur, But be it as it may, the Brisker Rav and the Briskers who follow after him, by the way, you know what they say about their Rav Chaim had three sons. One son was a very chashuv, a big tzaddik, but he became a businessman. He did not have an official position. But the other son was Rav Yitzchak Zev, who became the Brisker Rav, who came to Eretz Yisrael. And the other was Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, who came to America. And Rav Moshe Soloveitchik's children were Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik of YU and Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. So what they like to say is that the briskers who are in America are the Zionists, and the briskers in Eretz Yisrael are the anti-Zionists, which is quite true. Okay, but be it as it may, the brisker Rav was very, very unusual in his Yiras Shemayim, in his meticulous to mitzvahs, and to this very day, his family has all sorts of chumras about chametz and matzah, and their making of matzah is like literally an all-day thing, and the conditions that they require to bake matzah are like those things when they make microchips in computers. It has to be, you have to be sure that not a single speck of something comes in. They filter and they check for the dust, and they're really. So you would think, yeah. So, huh? They didn't.
What?
Well, okay, that's a good point, but okay, yeah. Now you're saying that the brisker Rav seems to be doing more than they were worried about in Mitzrayim itself. But I'll tell you the truth. Even if one is not like the brisker Rav, I'll tell you the truth. Everything we do about chametz is more than they did in Yetzias Mitzrayim. You know, even in the time of the Gemara, this idea that if flour and water are together for 18 minutes, it's chametz. That was not the original halacha. The original halacha was you actually inspected the dough for signs of fermentation, and if it didn't ferment, you could eat it. It's only because we're so afraid, we don't really know how to do these things anymore, that we have these absolute rules. And in the time of Chazal, which we absolutely don't do anymore, they would bake with fresh flour during Pesach, not matzah meal. And they would be willing to take their chances that there wouldn't be chametz. Today, nobody uses flour that could become chametz on Pesach. So bichlal, we become more cautious, and part of it is that we're less sure that we'll be careful enough, and therefore we're actually stricter than our forefathers might have been, because we don't want to take any chances, particularly Ashkenazim. That has been the tendency of Ashkenazic halacha. You constantly see in the poskim phrases like, we are no longer expert in this, we don't know how to do this, we have to be careful, we're not sure anymore, etc. Okay. But be it as it may, so you would think, if you would ask the brisker Rav, what is the most difficult commandment of Pesach? He would surely say, matzah, chametz, these are the things that they kind of go crazy over in a positive way because of the Yiras Shemayim. But he said, that's not the hardest mitzvah. The single hardest mitzvah of Pesach is this fourth element that says each person must regard themselves as if they themselves were taken out of Egypt. The whole year, it is memory or commemoration to remember the past. Pesach night, it is experiencing liberation. That's very, very difficult to actually experience. Now, in truth, the Rambam makes the mitzvah much, much easier by adding one letter to the word. According to the Rambam, instead of Chayav Adam Liros Es Atzmo, each person must look at themselves as if they were taken out of Mitzrayim, the Rambam is Gores in the Haggadah, Chayav Adam Laharos, just one little hay. Now, the difference in Liros and Laharos is very big. Liros is talking about, I must see myself as if I was liberated. Laharot just means, I have to behave, I have to show. And the Rambam says, I fulfill that by Dalit Kosos, by reclining. I show that I'm free. So according to the Rambam, it is not referring to an inner feeling. It is just referring to a behavior. But that's not our girsa. Our girsa in the Haggadah is not, I show that I'm free. I have to feel that I was taken out of Mitzrayim. And the brisker Rav said, that is the hardest mitzvah. So, b'kitzer, we have four distinctions between the mitzvah of Zechira b'chol yemos hashana and the mitzvah of Sipor. Again, number one, question and answer. Number two, beginning with the bad. Number three, explaining the significance of Pesach, Matzah, and Maror. And number four, the whole year is memory and commemoration. Pesach night is actual experience. By the way, this explains a bit of an enigmatic passage from Rav Haigon, who was the last of the Gaonim and the greatest of the Gaonim, where Rav Haigon points out, at the Leil Seder, we recite Hallel. Right? We have Hallel. And yet, we do not recite a bracha. Why don't I say, like every Hallel has a bracha, Sher Kiddushanu b'mitzvosav v'tzivanu likro es ha-Hallel. Why is there no bracha on the Hallel of Leil Seder? So Rav Hai Gon says the following phrase, which is very enigmatic. Ein anu korin b'toras kriya. We don't read Hallel because we're reading it. Ella b'toras shira. We are singing a song to Hashem. And the Hallel that is a song to Hashem doesn't have a bracha. Now, what does he mean? I mean, maybe you sing the Hallel, maybe you don't. But people sing Hallel, you know, in Shul also. What does he mean between the Hallel of Kriya and the Hallel of Kriya? So, the explanation is this. The Hallel of Kriya means the Hallel that is thanking Hashem for the redemptions of the past. So the mitzvah of Hallel says, I have to thank Hashem for what he did in the past. But Pesach night is the spontaneous thank you of experiencing redemption. It's one thing to say, if Hashem did a chesed for you last year, so the next year you got to say thank you. But if you're experiencing something right now, you're not saying thank you because there's a mitzvah to be grateful. You're saying thank you because you're actually experiencing something right now. That is called the spontaneity of Shiva. Okay. So, all of these points need a lot of elaboration, and we will talk about them at various points. But today, I just want to talk about the second point, to flesh that out a little bit. And that is, the second point is that in order to appreciate Yetzias Mitzrayim, you must begin with the bad and culminate in the good. Maschilin bignus u'mesayim b'shvach. If all you do is talk about the good part of the story, you're not yotzei the mitzvah. You gotta talk about the bad things. Why is that so essential? So, the simplest answer, and the simplest answer is also a true answer, is that it is the nature of gratitude of anything in life that we don't appreciate blessings unless we recall what life would be like without those blessings. People who come, let's say, who are Holocaust survivors, or people who come from countries of persecution, the former Soviet Union, they tend to be, whether they come to Eretz Israel or they come to the United States, they tend to be much more patriotic than people who were born in a free world, because they understand what persecution was like, they understand what suffering was like. In fact, the Chovos HaLevavos talks about the idea that, perversely, the greater Hashem's chesed, the more we take it for granted. The Chovos HaLevavos gives an example that, let's say, a person was born into slavery, persecution, suffering, sickness, starvation, and they spent years and years and years in that condition. And then after so many years, Hashem redeems them. How grateful they would be. How much they would love Hashem. But Nebuch, if Hashem put you into that situation from the beginning of your life, so the chesed is even greater because you didn't go through the suffering? For that reason itself, you don't appreciate it. You take it for granted. So the pashtus of Maschilin Vignosa Messiah Bishvach is, I got to remember the bad, because that enables me to appreciate the brachos that Hashem has given me. Whether those brachos are freedom, or whether those brachos are avodas Hashem, taking me from being an oved avodas Zarah. Same thing with health. Often a person appreciates health much more if chas v'shalom there was illness or the like. So that's a very true explanation. That's the nature of human beings, nature of everybody. We appreciate the good only when we remember the bad. But there's a kasha on it. As true as the idea is, there's a bit of a problem. And that is, it was Hashem that decreed that I would be in slavery. Hashem told Avraham Avinu that your children shall be enslaved and persecuted in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. So instead of talking about the slavery as a means of being grateful to Hashem, chas v'shalom, we could have the opposite problem. Well, why did you put me into slavery? So what's Hashem's answer? Well, listen, you should have been slaves 400 years. But I had rachamim. I took you out of 210 years. Thank me for 190 years early. Well, if I took you and I threw you in jail for a 400-year sentence, and I come after 210 years and says, be grateful, I'm releasing you 190 years early, your argument might be, well, why did you throw me in jail from the beginning? So the kasha is like this. If maschil b'gnusa m'sayim b'shvach simply means, in order to be grateful for the freedom, I have to experience the slavery, that's not going to generate hakaras hatov if the slavery itself was something evil and bad. So because of this, there has to be a deeper, more profound meaning to maschil b'gnus. It is not simply remember the bad so you'll appreciate the good, but in a deeper level, the so-called bad itself was part of the redemptive experience. Meaning to say, the freedom that one has after the slavery is not the same as simply putting you back to square one. Because if all, I was free, I was slave, I was free. If the freedom I have at the end is nothing more than the freedom I had before I walked into it, then one could have a taina, chas v'shalom, on the Ribbono Shel Olam, what did you do to me? Yeah, you took me out, why'd you put me in? But if we understand that the avdus itself is part of the redemption, I'll explain how that's shayach, then we understand that maschil b'gnus is a deeper understanding of seeing the redemptive potential. Seeing not only the light at the end of the tunnel, but seeing that even within the darkness of the tunnel itself, there is great light. And that is the Aveda of Maschil B'gnus Messiah Mishvach. Now, what does that mean practically? So in looking at Yetzias Mitzrayim, we can point out at least two things. The first is an observation of the Beis HaLevi. All of us know the well-known Gemaras and Midrashim, although there are variations between them, that although the Jewish people in Mitzrayim were on the 49th level of Tumah, and had they stayed even another minute, the amount of time it takes for their dough to turn chametz, you know, the 18 minutes, we don't even understand this. They would have hit level number 50, they would have been irredeemable. But they had certain zechuyas, certain merits. They didn't change their name, didn't change their language, they spoke Lashon HaKodesh. They wore the malbush of a Jew, whatever that was. Other midrashim say they didn't intermarry. They didn't speak Lashon Hara against each other. Now remember, the Jews in Mitzrayim were Ovdei Avodah Zarah, except for Shevet Levi. The Jews in Mitzrayim did not practice Bris Milah, which they were commanded to do, except for Shevet Levi. So they were not frum in any way. They were not religious. Right, they were not religious Jews. They didn't do bris milah. They worshipped idols. But what was their zechus? Their zechuyas were primarily a sense of avas Yisrael, achdus community. In other words, if somebody keeps his Hebrew name, what's the big deal? I mean, imagine, when I lived in Chicago, some of you who are from that part of the country may know. So there was a Devon Avenue, which is now largely Indian, but it was a totally Jewish street when I was there. And there was a kosher-style restaurant called The Bagel. It was a treif restaurant, but it was The Bagel. And I remember walking by once on Shabbos, and I saw a sign in the window that says, we serve cholent on Shabbos. So, you think about this. Here you have a treif restaurant. Somebody comes, I think they also say, and there was a free glass of wine for Kiddush. So, you know, treif wine, probably not, maybe it's mevushel, who knows, but, you know, treif wine, chilul Shabbos, treif food. But somebody walks by and says, I'd like to have cholent on Shabbos because that's what Bubby used to give me, you know, whatever it would be. So is there anything valuable about that? So on one level you could say, you know, this is a totally worthless thing. This is what they call gastronomic Judaism. This is the Judaism of the stomach. It neither involves the head nor the heart. And it's totally meaningless in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's eyes. That was my thought at the time, many years ago. But now, I'm not sure that that's correct. Because a person says, I want to be a Jew. I want to show myself. I want to connect myself to the Jewish people. I don't know mitzvahs. I don't keep halacha. I don't know any of that stuff. I don't even know what halacha is. I can't even say what I don't keep because I don't know what it is I don't keep. But this is something. And in Mitzrayim, that's exactly what started the redemption. And that is, a Jew looks at another Jew and says, we're suffering together. I want to keep the same name, a Jewish name. I want to speak Hebrew. I want to identify with Am Yisrael. And although that is not the purpose of redemption, the purpose of Yetzias Mitzrayim was Matan Torah, to be sure. But without that sense of achdus and connection and community, the Jewish people would have hit level number 50. As it were, they were level number 49, and that's only the one-fifth that survived. The four-fifths that died hit level number 50. So you're talking about people on the 49th level of Tuma. But what enabled them to be redeemed was this sense of Achdus and Achdus. Then Hashem gave them Pesach and Mila to kind of take them over the top. But what the reason Hashem gave them that mitzvah was because of that Achdus. So the person who wants to identify as a Jew is not a small thing. The guy that, you know, has his shirt open and wears a Magen David and goes by Rafi, you know, whatever it is. You know, we could look at that and say, not worth very much. But you never know. That person would have been one of the one-fifth that would have been Zocha to leave Mitzrayim. Because he says, I want to be a Jew. I want to identify as a Jew. So on one hand, you see from that Gemara that the Jewish people had achdus and unity and togetherness. And they didn't want to assimilate. They wanted to keep a distinctively Jewish language and names and the like. But the Beis Halevi says this is a kasha. Because the Medrash says that when Yosef died, the Jews said the following thing. If when Yosef was alive we were so successful, we were accepted, we were respected, we were admired, when we were living separately in Goshen, how much more so will the Umos HaOlam love us and admire us if we adopt their ways and interact with them? And therefore there was a wholesale movement towards assimilation, towards intermarriage, towards the attitude of Nia Kemitzriim. And that is why the Avdus came. So the Beis Levi asked the Kasha, which was it? Were the Jews desirous of assimilation in Mitzrayim? Or were the Jews desirous of keeping separate? The Beis Levi said, it's not a contradiction. Initially, the movement was towards assimilation because when they were wealthy, accepted, respected, they said, if we are so respected when we're separate, let's become like them. But then Hashem sent them to slavery. When a Jew tries to say, I can be just like the Goyim, when a Jew tries to say, I could be with the Umos HaOlam, Hashem will make the Umos HaOlam remind the Jew that you're different, you'll never be one of us. So the Beis Halevi says, Avdus was tremendously important. It was precisely the Avdus that caused us to know that we will never be totally accepted by the Umos HaOlam. All we have is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's all you need, and all we have is each other. And therefore the Avdus was the great springboard for Achdus and Avas Yisrael. Now it is a chaval that sometimes the only way we get together is when we see what the Umos HaOlam want to do to us, but those are the things that Hashem does, in the sense that if we don't come to this recognition on our own, then we will have the Umos HaOlam. When a Jew tries to forget that they're Jewish, that they're unique, that they have a destiny, that they have a role, then the Umos HaOlam become Hashem's Shaluchim to make us remember. So that was the first so-called Toeles of the Avdus. That it was the Avdus that made us recognize we have to be connected to each other, we have to love each other, we have to care about each other. Because nobody else does care. Hillel's famous words, Emein ani li mi li, if I'm not for me, who will be for me? That applies to Am Yisrael as a whole. again, we work with the world, we contribute to the world. Certainly Jews have contributed much to the world, and we're supposed to contribute to the world. But one also has to know, Rav Soloveitchik used to say, Avraham Avinu's famous words to Ephron Achiti, when he is negotiating to buy a grave after Sarah Imenu dies, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a stranger and I am a resident among you. This is the dichotomy of the Jew in the world. We are a toshav. We live in the world. We contribute to the world. We give to the world. We try to be law-abiding people wherever we live in the world. But a Jew also has to know that fundamentally one is a ger. Ger meaning a stranger in the world. And that is what Avdus taught us. That is lesson number one. So going back to the answer. So Maschil Begnusa Messiah Bishvach isn't simply looking at the bad and then appreciate the good, but to understand that the Avdus itself taught us an important lesson. But then there's a second lesson of the experience of Avdus. There's a pasuk in Devarim that says, V'yahavtem es ager, you shall love a ger, a person who converts to Judaism, must love them, ki gerim hayisem v'yeretz Mitzrayim, because you were gerim. Now, obviously, the word ger cannot mean just a convert, because the pasuk doesn't make sense. You should love the convert because you were converts. The answer is no. The reason for a convert is called a ger is because a non-Jew who joins Am Yisrael is coming without family, without relatives, without the Jewish geography that people are so fond of playing all the time. You know, my second cousin, you know, in Milwaukee, or whatever it is. In a time when society was land-based, like in Eretz Israel, land-based, they had no land. They were powerless. They had no connections. What is the Torah telling me? When you encounter a person that seems to be at the bottom of society, who is poor, without connections, without influence, without power, and you're sitting pretty in your land with your property and your power and your influence, treat them with love, compassion, and respect by remembering what it was like to be a nobody. You know, when people suffer emotional trauma of any type, there are different ways that people try to recover from it. One way is they try to distance themselves from the pain, and they put around themselves almost a shell, a hard shell, in which nobody's ever going to hurt me again. That all of my energy is devoted to not being connected to that, to making myself strong, although sometimes that strength is a brittleness, actually, in which I'm not going to be hurt. The Torah is giving us a remarkable insight here, a profound insight. And that is, when you've suffered pain, you don't forget that pain. Remember the feeling. Remember what it was like to be scared, to be lonely, to be oppressed, to be enslaved, to be looked down upon, to be despised. So when you meet another person that is going through that experience on some level, you will know what they are feeling like. And you will have a basis for kindness, compassion, and empathy. And it's been pointed out that linguistically, empathy is a different word than sympathy. Sympathy is the concept, I'm looking down. I'm up, and you're down, and I look down at you. It's noblesse oblige, in which the greater is taking care of the lesser. Empathy is the idea which Chazal called nosei bi'ol im chaveiro. We're in this together. I know what you're going through. I've been there. And because I've been there, I'm with you as you're going through this. That's a much, much deeper level. Sympathy is what one should have for an animal. Right? If a dog is in distress, I should have sympathy. But empathy is what you have for a human being. And this is why, even when Jews over the years have gone very, very far from Torah, there is within the Jewish personality this desire of standing up for the downtrodden. Why were Jews involved in civil rights? Why were they involved in apartheid? I would even say that the predominance of Jews in the early decades of communism, although communism was obviously a great, great mistake in every possible way, but it came from the misguided idea that this is the way you can alleviate the suffering of the poor and the downtrodden. Even our fellow Jews that are totally in the wrong track in terms of Palestinian rights, Palestinian state, you can call them crazy, you can call them blind, you can call them ignorant, you can call them many, many things. But I will tell you that it's the nature of a Jewish soul that a Jewish soul feels rachamim. And sometimes the rachmanis is misplaced and it's going to the wrong place, obviously, and it's not looking at the bigger picture of what is ultimately going to be rachamim. But it does come from that. That a Jew, as far as they might be from Torah, has some connection to that kedusha that leads them to behave certain ways. That's correct. So they're not taking that into account, 100%. So where did we get that? Where does a Jew get a feeling of rachmanis, a feeling of empathy, a feeling of feeling the pain of another? Well, on one level, it's from Avraham Avinu, of course, and on the other level, it's from Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. That's what the Torah says. Remember the stranger. That's why I would translate, although halakhically, of course, it means the convert. But, you know, stranger means stranger. Remember the stranger. The one homeless, without connections, without influence. The one that's the bottom of society. Because you were there. And if you were there, use your connection to your pain as a source of your empathy and compassion. And this is the deeper meaning of Maschil Bignus of Messiah Bishvach, that to see in the darkness the freedom that we had as a result of Yetzias Mitzrayim was not simply putting us back to where we were. We were changed as a result of that. And that's a lesson in life generally. A person has adversity. A person has choshech. And a person prays to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for a Yeshua. And if in Hashem's infinite rachamim, a person has a Yeshua, you can't just be the same way you were before this thing happened. Because if that's the question, the issue is, what did Hashem do? What's the use of this? But in some way, and every person has to identify, this is a vehicle of transformation in which you see in retrospect, and it may not be easy at all, not only the light at the end, but you see the light even within, how you become different, you become transformed. You know, many of you, I'm sure, have read the book All for the Boss, Rebbetzin Ruchama Shein, Olah Shalom's biography of her father, you know, Rav Sheinberg's father-in-law. And you may remember the story, but there's one part of the story at the very beginning of the book where he came over with his parents to the United States from Europe around World War I. And his parents went back to Europe right away. They couldn't make a living here. They just went back to Europe. And they left him in the United States alone. He was 11 or 12. And in those years, there was no child labor laws. You know, 11-year-old would get a job and work in a factory, a sweat house. And they set him up with a relative to pay rent. And the rental was something like $5 a week for rent. And he was able to manage that. But as soon as the parents left, the relative raised the rent to $10 a week. This little boy had no way of paying $10 a week. So he was evicted. Erev Shabbos, he was just kicked out. And he spent the first Shabbos in America without his parents, 11-year-old, in Central Park. And all he had, he was on a cold bench, and all he had were some rolls. There wasn't even an Arab there, so he couldn't even carry. He was kind of limited to the bench. And one can imagine. Now, again, Central Park was probably relatively safe in those days, but still, one could imagine how frightened he was, how lonely he was, how desperate he was, and what's going to happen after Shabbos? You know, maybe he'll get a job. He still needs a place to live. Where is he going to find a place to live? And in those days as well, if you were a Shomer Shabbos, and there were not that many Shomer Shabbos in America, You worked from Monday to Friday. You didn't come in on Saturday. You had to find a new job on Monday. You didn't have the federal government protecting Shabbos observant people. And anyway, he's a kid. He had no influence. He had no connections. He had no family that was willing to help him, obviously. So he prayed to Hashem for two things. He prayed to Hashem like Yaakov Avinu, if you give me lechem lecho, ubeged lilbash, right, give me bread, give me clothing, let me make a living, let me eventually have a bias. But then he prayed for something else. He prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he should never forget the pain that he feels this night. He doesn't want to forget that if he's zeicha to be successful in matzliach, he doesn't want to forget this night. So that whenever he meets people that are undergoing some comparable experience, he will have the rachmanis for them, because he understands what it's like. And he asked Hashem, the same tefillah, take me out of this, he says, but let me never forget this. Let me remember this. Let me remember what it's like. And if you know the rest of the story, Baruch Hashem, he was a matzliach economically, although he lost it in the Depression, but at least he became successful. He married, he had an Eishes Chayil, and his home did become an open home of hundreds and hundreds of people. Many of them were great Rosh Yeshivas, but he had a lot of people in his house that we would not appreciate as Shabbos guests. People who were homeless, people who were mentally handicapped in many, many ways. People who were abusive, people who would throw hot soup or hot cholent at him if it wasn't exactly to their liking. And these were not just people who stayed for 2 hours for lunch and then went home. They were people who stayed in the house for 6 months at a time. And people would ask the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin, like, how can you bear this? How can you stand this? These are crazy people. They don't appreciate anything. They complain all the time. They're mentally deranged. And he said, if you had gone through what I had gone through, you would understand. I know what they're feeling. I know what is going through their minds and their hearts and their emotions. And if you know it because you've lived it, you can have empathy and compassion for anyone that is suffering. And this is really the inner meaning of Maschil Bignos Umasayim Beshvach, to see the redemptive potential in adversity. It's a great, great lesson. Because in every life there's going to be all sorts of choshech. And if the whole purpose of the Rachamim of Hashem is to get us out of bad places, but we don't grow from those bad places, then whatever Hashem does, I'm going to have a taina on, because why'd you put me in it to begin with? Just to put me where I was? I'll just end with one other story, actually involving a non-religious Jew, but it's a Jew, and I think the neshama of the Yid is speaking. There was, I'm not sure if he's still alive, he might be still alive, there was a very, very famous classical pianist, Leon Fleischer. And Leon Fleischer was very, very big in the 50s, 60s, early 70s. But then, because he was an obsessive perfectionist, he had repetitive stress injury in his right hand. And he was not able to play professionally. And he went all over the world for different types of treatments, and none of the treatments worked. And he was so despondent, he wanted to kill himself. I mean, basically, music was his life. It was his, the whole purpose of his existence. If he couldn't play music, he saw no reason to even live. But eventually, you know, he got over it, and he became one of the great piano teachers of the next generation of classical pianists in Peabody, in Baltimore. And he really taught many, many people who became famous, who became very well known, and the like. So I believe that something like 25 years after he lost the use of his right hand, his wife read about some deep tissue massage in Japan. And she said, you know, let's go to Japan, maybe you could try it, who knows. And he didn't want to open up that box. He said, you know, listen, it took me years and years to get over this. I'm a teacher. I'm happy. I have Talmidim. I don't want to get my hopes up. If I get my hopes up and it doesn't work, I am not going to be able to recover. I don't want to try it. But she convinced him, you know, it's so good, rate of success, you know, let's see. So he tried it. And Baruch Hashem, you know, he got the use of his hand back, although I think it atrophied afterwards. But he had 5 years of playing. 5 years. And because he had been teaching all of these years, his skills did not atrophy. He was able to play at a very high professional level. He had 5 years that were given to him because of this. That's a very nice story, but the reason I'm sharing it with you is I want to tell you something that Leon Fleischer said about himself. Very remarkable thing for a person who is not formally religious. He said that all of the years that he was performing, he says his life was about him. He got the fame, he got the applause, he got the kavod. And Hashem said, you know, I gave you gifts, but I don't want your life to be about you. I want you to learn to care about someone else. I want you to learn to care about letting somebody else get the kavod, somebody else getting the accolades. So he says, so God took away my talent, took away my ability, forcing me to give of myself to build up other people. And after a while, he said, I was teaching for so many years, the accomplishments of my Talmidim, my students, became as joyous to me as whatever accomplishments I had. I glorified in their goodness. I glorified in how much they accomplished. So then, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, okay, you've gotten over your ego, I'll give you back your gift. And now you can... Now, I understand that not every story is always going to be as neat, although this itself was a 25-year trajectory. But this is kind of the message in which something that could be a devastating, devastating loss can be the mysterious vehicle of transformation and growth. And this is the inner meaning, once again, of maschil b'gnus and mesayim b'shvach. That gnus itself becomes the source of our praise. Be'ezras Hashem, we should be zeichin these parshiyos to experience the real Yetzias Mitzrayim, to be liberated from all the Mitzrayims that enslave us.